Hi, it's Rabbi Jim Eagle. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Well, this week we're going to take a little bit of a look at two different issues that are somewhat connected. We're going to take a visit back to a previous show, and then we're going to actually head into the issue of what do we do with Shlach Lecha. I thank you so much for joining me, and again, Shavua Tov. Before I begin, I have to pause and comment on an act which I consider to be significant. In our Torah portion, we'll read of the decree for the Israelites to wander the desert. Taking the commentary and not the report of the spies was the mistake of the Israelite community. And lest anyone have missed an event and be left with only my commentary, I wanted to share this important piece of news and my understanding. A few weeks ago, I grilled, with cayenne pepper and hot sauce, a certain Pastor Hagee due to his comments regarding Hitler and the Holocaust. I felt then, and I still feel, that his comments at that time were inappropriate at best, and could have easily been closet anti-Semitism. I found it remarkable that Pastor Hagee issued an apology for his comments within the past few weeks. And for this, I have to give him credit. While it does not whitewash his previous comments, Pastor Hagee has placed himself at least a little above some other evangelical preachers by showing a degree of humility for his actions. This is important because too often previous ministers said hateful things and did nothing when called upon to explain. I would share with Pastor Hagee and with all of you that this act is a good first step to creating a better understanding. According to Judaism, repentance happens when we apologize and then cease to do the hurtful or harmful thing. My hope for Pastor Hagee and all of us is that this was the last time we ever hear such words from him. I also hope he can find a way to make amends with other communities against which he has lashed out so that all people of faith can find a way to appreciate the good things that religious people can accomplish together. This sometimes starts with the courage to admit a mistake. So we come to the story of the spies in the Torah this week. This is truly one of the most famous or infamous stories in the Torah because of the subsequent degree that this generation of Israel would be punished in that they would never enter the Promised Land. After a few epic revolts last week, somehow God believes that the people are ready to go into the Promised Land. Now I'm going to digress here for a moment and just share a personal story with you. I once led a Torah study where a friend, I put that in quotes, of a Baptist minister showed up to the library in Jackson, Mississippi. The friend asserted that the Israelites actually asked God to be able to go into the land. I wondered where he got this explanation from, and because shlach is in the command tense in Hebrew. And then I found the commentary after searching for Rashi and shlach. Rashi, quoting Midrash Tanchuma, now I have fulfilled the mitzvah of quoting my sources, says, shlachacha, send for yourself. According to your own understanding, I am not commanding you, but if you wish, you may send. since the Israelites had come to Moses and said, "Let us send men ahead of us," as it says in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 22, "all of you approached me." Moses took counsel with the Shekhinah. "By their lives," which kind of means damn them, "now I will give them the opportunity to err through the words of the spies, so that they will not inherit it," meaning the land of Israel. So the problem with this commentary is first that the word shlach is in the command tense. I don't know of many who say, "Go, please, if you feel like it." Compare this to Avram, who gets the call, "Lech Lecha." And we generally don't argue that God was doing nothing more than sending a party invitation. It was immediate. It needed to happen. Additionally, there's the theological problem. Theology like this gives religion a bad name. When it comes to God setting up humans for failure, this lesson from Rashi and the Midrash, that God is, at best, a bystander in the affairs of humans, or, at worst, when something bad happens, we get the divine, "I told you so," and we wonder why people might be led to say that religion doesn't speak to them. No, actually, the real reason for the punishment, which ironically ties into our Torah portion, is that the commentary of the spies and their actions resulted in the decree that the Israelites would wander for 40 years. The reports essentially are the report of the 10 spies and then the statement by Caleb. Now, Caleb's words are not in opposition to those of the 10 spies. In fact, Caleb seems to agree with them. But Caleb sets a visionary and bold action. He says, "Let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." The spies don't engage a debate at that moment, but according to the text, they spread dibat aretz. They start a smear campaign regarding the goodness of the land. They say that the land consumes its inhabitants. Just an aside, you know, smearing was not invented by certain political operatives in our country. Back to our Torah portion. Thus, they did not engage in questions of substance. They sought to have a discussion focused squarely on the fears of the people. In other words, the other spies, to cope with their fears, sought to make God a liar. When Joshua and Caleb again attempt to have a discussion based on fact, the now scared to death community threatened to pelt them with stones. One of the challenges we face in the Jewish world today is that many of the ideas that we have about the Jewish world that we grew up in, that world doesn't exist anymore. It has radically changed over the past 20 years. It has changed because of the way people connect to each other, how we stay in touch, and how we respond when we are not the same. The ability of any leader to inspire, as Caleb tries to do in the Torah portion, comes at the cost of seeing how many people are bending over to pick up a stone after the leader is done speaking. Ours has turned into a culture of professional stone hurlers, as various talk show hosts and television pundits who report not on the whole issue at hand and its long-term repercussions, but on how something that might benefit us as a country in the long run is going to mean some changes, possibly some difficulties in the short run. This has also impacted the synagogue and the Jewish community. Today we are struggling to create synagogues and Jewish community that makes a real difference in the lives of people. The problem is that the difference experienced by previous generations are not going to be the differences appreciated by our younger generations. Why doesn't this new generation join and get involved like the previous generations? Let's first talk about their lives and their histories. I heard this quoted by a rabbi who was sharing a list from Beloit College in Wisconsin, and the faculty was trying to be trained in what would their new incoming freshmen look like. What could they really expect? Here's some of the facts. The lifetime of the entering freshmen of 2007-2008, their lifetime has always included AIDS. The CD was introduced before they were born, and if you show them a record album, they don't realize that music can be played on both sides. Their evening news probably comes from Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, and they probably think Cronkite is the name given to someone who got crunked, or Cronkite is a new form of concrete. They don't have a clue how to use a typewriter, and they don't know what to do when the bell goes off. They think the Berlin Wall might be a rock climbing activity. They tell time by looking at their cell phones or PDAs. They think that boys can do anything when they grow up. Their history of music class includes the study of the Beatles. They've invented their own language to use in text messaging, and they have a chip on their shoulder, but chances are they also have one in their pockets as well, because chips have defined most of their world. To quote a popular film, "I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, Toto." In the Torah portion, they weren't in Egypt anymore. And today, we are not in the 20th century anymore. We are beyond the forces that once drove us together, such as anti-Semitism, discrimination, and attempting to remake the shtetl in the United States. This does not mean that these are no longer factors in the world, but they have lost much of their ability to be the driving forces that bind our community. We are now faced with a new challenge, and the challenge is us. How do we create compelling, positive reasons to do things in the Jewish world? How do we become Caleb, who said, "Let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it"? How do we say, "By all means, let us look at our Jewish community, its institutions, and our structures, and make sure that we reinvent and recreate a synagogue community for the 21st century"? If we think about this in the stages of mourning, we are currently saying goodbye to a generation, specifically the World War II generation. At first, our responses to their demise and the lack of the next generation was really denial. We kind of said to ourselves, we're burying one generation, but we can't seem to get the next generation to take their place. And we placated ourselves, saying things like, "They'll join when they are ready." As time went, the question of when and ready and what did they mean began to take their toll, and we began to wonder if and would they ever join and be part of the community we had built. Then anger has arrived when we begin to create an in and an out of the community. This is also the point in the Torah portion where the community began scanning the landscape for stones, specifically those with very sharp edges. If we respond to the changes that we are facing in our society the way we have been, we're going to look like the following story, which I really love. It goes like this. Two ostriches were standing side by side, their heads in holes in the ground. One ostrich said to another, "How do we know when it's safe to come out?" Denial has many forms. Some of them are refusing to admit that there is a problem. Yet another form of denial is nostalgia. If we keep our heads buried in the sand or have the wool of nostalgia wrapped like a blindfold around our eyes, we will be limited at best regarding what we can do. However, if we look at the synagogue and Jewish community as institutions that are meant to express Jewish meaning and values, that they have a universal voice and impact upon the entire world, we are charged to do whatever we can to find ways to connect people to those important values. Programs are just expressions of values, and fear cannot be an enduring value. It is little more than a reaction. Should you, would you have listened to Caleb? Or would it have been easier to search for a rock solid answer to the possibility of having a purposeful and meaningful existence? Caleb sought to take the people from fear to faith. If we are going to create synagogue and Judaism that speaks to future generations, we have to be ready to follow the Calebs, to follow the people who would lead us regardless of our fears, because the price of failure is unacceptable. It's absolutely too high. It was the other spies who started the Debat Aretz, the fear campaign against Caleb, by playing on the fears of the community. If we are afraid of failure, it is because we care about our Judaism and its highest aspirations. Risking failure is often the best and sometimes the only way to prove that something is meaningful, enduring, and important to ourselves and others. Risking failure sometimes means saying, "Let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." I wish you a Shavua Tov.